Hey everyone, welcome back. This is episode 22 of Christian History and Ideas. I'm John Coleman, and I'm joined today, or I am joining, Dr. Nirmal Das. How's it going, Dr. Das?
Great to be here, John. How's it going with you?
It's going. It's chugging along. 2021 is quite a year, as there have been a lot of other quite a year. So
we're doing exactly, well. Yes.
All right. So we're looking today, continuing really our discussions over the past three shows of Christianity in the East. We began with Tibet. We're going to return to Tibet today. In the intervening times, we also looked at larger Christian history in China, as well as the whole subject of the Church of the East and Nestorianism, and some very interesting cultural looks as well as artistic looks of a huge slice of church history, which is pretty much completely forgotten in the West. So, as is our custom, we will begin with a text, and this recording we happen to have appropriate, again, to the time of our episode being filmed, as well as to this topic of the gospel and the gospel spreading, especially to far-flung areas. We have the antiphon at Known from the time of Epiphany in the Liturgy of the Hours. So the antiphon reads, "I have raised you up as a light for all the nations. Through you, my salvation will be proclaimed to the ends of the earth." So with that, Dr. Das, I'll kick it back to you and let me know when you want me to bring up the different artworks and quotes and all these goodies that we have.
Sure. Thanks, John. So I thought we would continue our discussion by heading a little bit south and look at Christianity in Tibet. Last time we talked, you had mentioned that very interesting article you were looking at with that church in Tibet. And I thought we would, you know, dig a little deeper and see that that church was not some, you know, anomaly that, you know, just kind of happened to be there, but rather it's part of a very old, I would say, ancient tradition of Christianity in that part of the world. And that's what I would like to, you know, dig into a bit here and to look at how old this is and what kind of Christian tradition existed in this part of the world. To set the context, I guess, is that we've been looking at this time period of about 600 to about 900. And this is really the dynamic period for Eastern Christianity. Thanks, John. And also, if you wouldn't mind, John, if you could pull up a map of what I would like to talk about, and that is the Tibetan Empire. It's one of the empires that few people talk about or know about, but it was a very dynamic part of that part of the world that we should consider. So if you could, just bring that up if you could. I think that blue is really good, or this at the bottom.
The second one over?
Yeah, the first one in the second row.
First one in the second, yes, great. I don't know who makes these maps, but they're very helpful.
Yeah, they're good.
Seem like they take a lot of time to make.
It's very small, but maybe you could, there we go. Good. So notice how huge that is. So it encompasses parts of China, India, Central Asia. So when we're talking about the Tibetan Empire, we're looking at a very influential culture, for lack of a better term. And this existed from about the early parts of 600 AD to about mid 800, I think about 840, 842 or something like that AD, that's when it starts to break apart. So it has a 300 year run as a very powerful empire in this part of the world. And because it's a powerful empire, it exerts a lot of influence around the area. Which also then means, of course, that Tibet was not as we understand it to be, i.e. a backwater of a backwater of a backwater, cut off from everywhere, a land unknown, a land of mystery and so forth, that somehow is a fossil, you know, from some ancient time period. No, we're looking at an area that was very dynamic, very much understood itself to be part of the larger world, and indeed ruled, you know, various different portions of that larger world. And because it was part and parcel of this larger world, it was well aware of, say, the Persian Empire, the Roman Empire, and it had communication with those two empires, i.e. merchants, embassies, political influence, political dynamics, all of that sort of thing was going on at this time with the Tibetan world. So when we're talking about Christianity, which we've been discussing so far, we've talked about the monasteries that were around in this part of the world. We talked about the influence, you know, settlements and so forth. And given the extent of this empire, it would be, of course, wrong for us to think that we're talking about an isolated nation. And since it was obviously not such, what we're also then talking about is that the Tibetan Empire was heavily influenced and evangelized by the Christian faith. And of course, again, this is the Christian faith of the Church of the East, the church that belonged in the Persian Empire rather than the church that belonged in the Roman Empire. And as such, Tibet, of course, preserved a lot of its ancient Christian history. And that we're now slowly discovering, which is really interesting. Again, like I said last time, when we start looking at this sort of dynamic, we have to then keep in mind that when we're talking about the more normative faith system of this time, of this area now, Buddhism, again, Buddhism is not a religion that comes out of a vacuum. It's part and parcel of a very deep context. And that context is heavily Christian in this part of the world. And that we have to keep in mind always. We should get away from that habit of thinking that these things or these places are isolated, and what we're looking at are fossils of very ancient traditions that somehow evolved all on their own. And now we have the benefit of going and visiting them and touching something really pristine and ancient. That's a nice...
That's always the danger of, it's the double-edged sword, isn't it, of categories, whether those are historical epochs or physical territorial borders or intellectual categories, is that they can be extremely incisive and illuminating to a reality, but they lose the nuance of the reality, oddly enough, by their categorization.
Exactly. And they also then lead us astray.
Yeah.
We somehow think that we know it more, we know it better than, say, what happened back then or whatever. It gives us a certain kind of an arrogance, which I think is always fatal to a historical understanding of reality. And I think it's also something we discussed earlier. It's part and parcel of this fabulism that is part of the modern mindset, i.e. we're all back in Plato's cave staring at the wall and the images on it. We love staring at the images and we create all kinds of fables around those things. And this isolation of the East is one of those big fables. Part and parcel is the whole education system, what we call Orientalism and all this.
Where's my Saeed? Where's my...
Exactly, your Saeed.
It's right out of my... Here, hold on. Here's one of his books. It's not Orientalism, but here's...
John, get rid of the map. I can't see. We can't see.
Okay.
We can't see Orientalism.
You're going to have to define that for us, Dr. Das. So
Edward Said. There we go.
There you go. Yeah, what's Orientalism? He made it famous back in the 70s.
John, you want to address it quickly? Yeah.
Oh, sure. Orientalism is this concept which was the title of a book by Edward Said, who is this Palestinian-American scholar from...
And Christian, by the way.
Yes, he was, yes. Was it NYU? Or he was down in New York, anyway.
Yeah.
And he noticed, the elephant in front of everyone, which is this concept of the Orient, which Westerners such as ourselves kick around. And this concept that he delineates in this, originally an essay, which was published, I think, in 76 as a book called Orientalism, he notices that these characteristics that when Westerners are talking about the Orient, they are meaning the Middle East and or everything across North Africa to the Middle East, and that they use the exact same term for all these people, and that they all seem to have the character. There seems to be, if you look at the artwork and so forth, I have a presentation on my own channel about that book where I give you artwork and things. So there's a lot of sensuality in the artwork. There's a lot of lethargy. And also in the way people speak and portray, Westerners portray the East, there's a lot of lethargy. There's usually some use of narcotics, the hookah or whatever. There's also violence at the same time, oftentimes. There's also very often a monument in the background that's decaying. So everyone's like loafing around at like, some temple or something from 1,000 years before. And also this idea, the Orientalism, that one place is interchangeable and one time period with another place and time period completely removed. Said gives the example he was reading, I believe he was trying to find out about Syria, and this guy was talking about Syria in the 19th century, and Said was reading about this explanation, and he says, this sounds very familiar, I've read this somewhere, and it's actually from like some guy from the 1700s talking about Egypt or Libya. But something, and this is the whole point of Orientalism, I think I've expressed it here, and Dr. Das can ask for more clarifications, but the whole point is that Westerners use this term in this final example, from 200 years before, from 1,000 miles away, and they apply it to a totally different area. But in the Western mind, all of that could be the Orient. And that book really torpedoed the whole discipline of Orientalism. No one except for old Bernard Lewis until into the 21st century was still declaring themselves an Orientalist after Said.
Exactly. That's a great summary. exactly right. And so what we're really looking at then is an Orientalism when we look at, these areas and when we talk about the context of Christianity, because we've made all these assumptions about the Orient. And these assumptions lead us into all kinds of conclusions that have nothing to do with the historical reality of these places. And of course, one of those conclusions that Orientalism has given us is that of isolation, that all these cultures have been deeply isolated, and it's only now that we're discovering them. And because we're discovering them just now, what they're presenting us is unique, untouched, pure, and so forth. And this is a very powerful fable because people, live by it. The entire, modern understanding of spirituality outside of Christianity depends upon this fable. But it's a very peculiar, mindset. So my point is, with all of this, and it's a topic we should, look at some other time. But the point is that what we're really talking about are situations, historical reality, that is vastly different from what we assume it to be. this is not what happened on the ground in Tibet. Tibet was not isolated, for example, to go back to our discussion. It was not an isolated place. It wasn't a backwater of a backwater. It was a very dynamic, happening and rich area, an influential area. And I think that's the key. So we should try to break away from this Orientalist habit of mind that we're so much in love with, which is, of course, minimizing the Oriental or Eastern cultures. But more importantly, I think it is hindering us from fully understanding what is going on. So we need to shed our basic assumptions about these places and open up our understanding to greater horizons. Having said that, what we're really talking about then is that Tibet has had a very, very ancient and very deep connection with Christianity. Yes, John is showing us the more famous cover of Orientalism.
And if I could interject, it took Said a very long time to figure this out. So I'm just relaying what he said in one of his final interviews, a very interesting 3-hour presentation before he died of, I think, leukemia. You'll notice in the upper bar below the title, and then above this thing, it says the 25th anniversary. You see a lot of these squiggles that kind of look like Arabic.
Right.
And they certainly do look like Arabic. They're actually not, right? It's total gibberish, but this is a good example. So you have the sensuality with the violence, with the lethargy, with the white guy a little bit higher than all the black guys that are all loafing around, with the temple that was once great, but it's kind of decaying. This is a good, perfect snapshot of Orientalism.
Great, yes.
All right. So I'll bring up the map there, Dr. Das.
Sure, yes. Let's do that.
All right. Here we go.
Good. So this is the area we're looking at. Now, again, this area had temples and churches and monasteries. And in one of those monasteries, we have had, various documents that we have found. We'll look at those in a minute. I don't want to jump ahead, before. But what I would like to start our discussion off with is a quotation from a patriarch or archbishop of the Church of the East, a man by the name of Timothy the First. And Timothy the First is right. Around 780 in a letter, and I would like for John to read that little bit for us, that letter, and then we can discuss it.
Absolutely. Here we go. Quote, man, your friend is named God Isho Mi Ishiaha and acts as Varapa Ishir Sayamuri. And when the doors of the heaven with seven layers will be opened, you will pursue the yoga, that is the way of conduct, that you will receive from the judge at the right hand of God. And what you will have thought, do it with shyness, unscared, undaunted. You will become a jinnah. You will become blissful, that is. There will be no demons of sickness or impediments. This lot, for whatever caste, is very good.
Now, notice something very interesting about this little passage from a letter. Now, this letter, of course, is written by the bishop what we would call the archbishop or even the cardinal, to the church in Tibet. Idea of addressing a church in a particular area is, very interesting historically. But the point is that this document informs us about the dynamics of Christianity in this part of the world. Notice, first of all, the name of Jesus that appears in the first line. And this is Isho. And this is the Syriac version of the more normative Semitic form of Jesus's name. Do you know that in Arabic, John?
In Arabic, it's in proper Arabic, it's Yeshua al-Masiyah. Yeah. And then in the Islamic world, from the Quran, he's called Isa, but typically it's Yeshua.
Yeah. So this is a combination of, this is probably a very early Semitic version of Yeshua or Isho, it comes down to, and of course the second part is Mashiach, which is in again in Arabic Mashiach, but again Messiah is what we know this term as. But notice how central that concept is. So your friend is a God named Jesus the Messiah. This is what we're suggesting. And this is to mankind, all of it, all of mankind, as your friend is this God. And notice, Jesus is not referred to as a prophet or some guy, but as a God. So again, the divinity of Christ is maintained by the Church of the East, as opposed to what people usually think about Nestorianism, i.e. the rejected God's, Christ's divinity, his godhood. And we can forget the various terminologies like the Vajrapani and the Shri Sakyamuni and all that. But what the interesting thing is that when it refers to the heavens, it says it has seven layers, i.e. there's seven heavens that we're talking about. This is a very ancient Christian Jewish understanding of heaven, that heaven has these various layers, just like, you know, Dante has the layers of hell and also of heaven and all this sort of thing. It's a very ancient understanding of what the geography of heaven is all about, and the highest is where Jesus and God live. The other thing I would like us to take a look at in this passage is that Jesus is referred to as a judge, and he sits on the right hand of God. These two terms are very familiar to us, of course, as Christians, because these are something very understandable, because they're creedal. They're part of our creed that we know quite well. what this then suggests, what this then suggests is that what we're really looking at is a creedal statement of the East. If we focus in on these three things, Jesus is God, Jesus in heaven, and Jesus judging and sitting at the right hand of God, notice it's not so radically different from what, you know, passes for, say, the Nicene Creed, that is what the creedal statements are. So what we're then discussing here is that in Tibet, the context of Christianity is very, very traditional, for lack of a better term. It isn't heretical in any shape or form. So again, the idea of Nestorianism as heretical breaks down completely from this document, which is not, you know, something from outside this area, but right inside the Tibetan Empire. This is where this document comes from. And it lays lays the groundwork of the faith that we're talking about, the Christian faith that we're talking about.
The Church of the East, or indeed, is it in its Chicago home, a synodal church? Is it very patriarchal? How do you know how it might have been organized, especially at this time period, and how it would delineate doctrine?
Sure. It was very much in the, you know, apostolic tradition of the church hierarchy. I.e. it had the patriarch and the archbishops and the bishops and the presbyters and all that sort of thing. And how they communicated were through councils that they held, and through, various synods. They did have synods as well. This is part of the structure that was established. And it very much mirrored the structure in the West as well. Very similar to that in that regard. What was different, of course, was what was expected of priests and bishops and all that sort of thing, i.e. whether they could be married or not and all that. That was what the main differences were. But structurally, it was very similar to the one in the West, i.e. it had the synod, it had the episcopate, and so forth. it followed through with all of that structure that we're familiar with. And more interestingly enough, it also had a way method of communication, what we would call a mail system, i.e. so a letter like this could be written and sent all the way to Tibet. This letter was probably written in what is now modern day Iraq, perhaps Babylon, some think Edessa, because this person, this patriarch Timothy the First, is a very mysterious, we don't really know too much about him. As we don't know much about a lot of this stuff, actually, because it has been very little researched. And it's very, you know, recently that we're just, you know, finding still documents and interpreting them. So it had a very interesting dynamic mail system, communication method, which would get, probably using the Silk Road and the caravans going this way and that. But this mailing system allowed for very rapid communication to happen, and of course also allowed for ideas to spread very quickly. So the point then is that when we talk about, say, Tibet in this part of the world, we're talking about a very established church. It's not something that is foreign to anything contextual that is Eastern, i.e. notice it's using the terminology that is familiar to people. The Sanskrit terms, Vajrapani, basically in Sanskrit means holder of authority, power, basically a holder, someone who holds authority. Sakyamuni means he that, helps you along. This is Sanskrit. That's not strictly Sanskrit, it's Prakrit, a little later division version. Unlike Greek, Sanskrit did, of course, keep developing into different languages and so forth. So notice it's using those terminology that was familiar in this part of the world. It's not using Greek terminology. We would expect Greek terms to be used in this context in the West. Here, Sanskrit terms are being used, and of course other Persian words will be used, or Sasanian, Sogdian words will be used. These are Persian languages, Persianate languages, I should say. that is the vocabulary, that is the common context that is being deployed in order to convey the Christian message. And that's the interesting thing here. So it's a Christian message entirely removed from the Greek context. And I think that is the key that we need to take away from all of this stuff. This is an entirely different, context, different culture that we're dealing with. And yet the message, notice, the creedal version of the message is unchanged. Mm-hmm. Jesus is God. Jesus sits at the right hand of God. He's the Son of God, et cetera, et cetera. And the seven-layered heaven and whatnot is just something interesting that we don't have to worry about, but it's there as well. So it happens. Now, what I would like to suggest with this is that the other things that have come out from these various places in Tibet is rock carvings of crosses, of crosses. And there's another one, John, that if you could, another one, can we keep going to the last? Yeah, there we go. This is specifically Tibetan. And if you look at the top right hand.
Hold on, don't wanna go on Twitter, hold on.
Yeah, we don't wanna go to Twitter.
Stand by, try to blow it up and see what happens to my good deeds. See what happens to me.
Yeah.
I think we're going to have to content ourselves with this one. Hold on now.
Yeah, just leave it at that. That'll be fine.
There we go.
That's good enough. But what you have on the right hand is Sogdian, which is a Persianate language. It should be, imagine it being, flipping right over, and so it's standing on its, up, and you would read it from top to bottom. And that's how you're going to be reading it. That's it. It's a very difficult passage, by the way, to interpret. but it seems to be saying that, you know, this was written in some this time period. Where it's a very contentious thing. The scholars don't really know what this means. It's a very difficult, for some reason, to interpret. And what is it's also suggesting is that it's mentioning the word Jesus in there. Again, in the normative version of Jesus's name in this part of the world, which is Isa. It's no longer Isho anymore. Isho, I think is a Sanskritized version of the Arabic, Syriac. I shouldn't say Arabic. But at this time now, Isa is becoming the normal, and this text mentions Isa, is becoming the normal form of Jesus's name in this part of the world.
Is that because of Islamic influence?
That's later, but really it's a Syriac, Persian influence.
Mm.
Yeah, Islam is not going to be influencing this part of the world yet, but Islam is going to be influenced by these kinds of this tradition as well. So they're using the term Isa shows up here, and Mesiha becomes part of that phrase as well. So Jesus and Messiah together are mentioned in the Sogdian text to the right on top. Now to the bottom, of course, obviously, is the cross. And notice it's the Eastern cross, i.e. commonly known as the Nestorian cross. We might as well use that term because that's what they use. But anyway, it's the Eastern cross. But notice, interestingly enough, it's a cross that is emerging out of two petals. And this is probably the lotus petal that is being depicted here. And so the cross is emerging out of the lotus. Of course, the lotus is going to have a lot of, it's a heavy-duty iconography, in Buddhism. But notice it's preceding Buddhist iconography. And this is the interesting thing. So we have an earlier version of the lotus being used in a religious context, but that context is not Buddhist. That context, obviously, is Christian. And this, like I said, this is a specifically Tibetan artifact, a remnant, and it points to something very interesting. Two things. First, the prevalence of an iconography that is going to be adopted later on by Buddhism, the lotus, and thereby afterwards that into Hinduism as well. And secondly, the use of Sogdian, which is a Persian language, so it's not the language of the natives of Tibet, but it's the universal language that has been used for universal communication. Just like we would use language, English functions this way in our world. We assume that everyone will know English if we put something out, and you usually do. It is the universal language. In that part of the world, the universal language was Sogdian, or a Persian version of the Persian language. And that was the prevalent language used throughout this area. Everyone spoke it. It was the common tongue. And this, again, we touched about this recently, but we'll mention it again. It's worth mentioning. When we're talking about language in this context, in the ancient world generally, but especially in the East, we're talking about language. We're not talking about unilingualism. We're talking about multilingualism. Most people could speak two or three or even four languages. Why? Because you needed that many languages to get by in the world. You couldn't just speak one language and have a good life. But if you wanted to communicate with the world around you, you needed more than one language. And usually that meant knowing two to three to four languages. So this tells us then that Tibetan culture is not cut off. It's part of the larger Persian Empire, or it's certainly not, I shouldn't say that way. It's aware of the Persian Empire and wants to communicate with it because it's an empire in its own regard. And it's probably regarded as such by the Persian world. And notice how, closely it, in that map, closely it merges with the Persian world. So because of this kind of internationalism of the Tibetan world, it's not surprising, therefore, to find this kind of influence or presence of Christianity. The other thing I should mention is that, and by the way, there are a lot of these Christian crosses in Tibet, and interestingly enough, they're difficult to find, on the internet. It's difficult to find images of them. And it's only in very hard to get books that these images have been printed. I have not been able to get a hold of these books for the very simple reason is because they're very expensive to buy, because they're, they were printed in the early 1900s, printed in the early 1930s and 20s and so forth. And a lot of them are in German and French, because that's who was doing a lot of the work in this part of the world. And so they're very difficult to find. But I would encourage people to, look around. You never know. And if you do come across these things, do put them on the internet so other people can see. So some, gracious soul has put this image up for us to look at. But there are other crosses that have been found in Tibet, quite a few of them. And they should be, more widely known. But unfortunately, since they're hard to get, and I don't know what the situation is now in Tibet, what has happened or what is going on, whether these, things are still around to be photographed. But if, the point is there's a lot of these kinds of artifacts that were found in the early parts of the 1900s. probably most of them are in museums, but unfortunately they're not so easily available for us to look at. So this was the best I could come up with to give us an idea. But they do follow this same sort of pattern. And because they follow this sort of pattern, it's really interesting to see them, to see them in their context. The other thing I would suggest with Tibetan Christianity is that it had a very deep influence, but it was a faith system that was not openly rejected. This idea of Christianity disappearing from these parts of the world is part of a very active political effort, first by Buddhism, then in this part of the world by Lamaism, the Lamaist faith system, and thirdly, through various political actions, for lack of a better term. And those political actions, of course, are going to be perpetrated by the next version of Christianity that gains a foothold and then becomes dominant, and that is Islam. Because Islam is part and parcel. It, of course, doesn't emerge out of some vacuum, but it's coming out of this tradition of the East Church of the East. That is its context. And it is the Church of the East's version of Arianism. That's what, for the context. Just the Roman Empire had Arianism, the Church of the East had Islam to contend with. In the West, the dynamic was different. Arianism was overcome. In the East, the dynamic was different. Christianity, the Church of the East, was overcome by its version of Arianism. And of course, this is what we have today. So we, in a way, we still have the Christian world that was there in the East. It's only been dominated by one heresy of that church, of the Church of the East. And that has become the dominant faith system. Whereas the normative Orthodox system that was there, the faith system disappeared or became marginalized. And of course that was through political means. We briefly talked about the Mongols and their dynamic in the sense that they were promoting Christianity always and didn't like Islam, because by this time Islam is of course now emerging, and Islam probably emerges in the Persian Empire. So this idea, we can talk about this some other time, the early history of Islam, but this idea that Islam bursts out of Mecca and Medina and Saudi Arabia is a fable. it probably is. It's part and parcel of the most. It comes out of the largest Christian city in this area, which John, you mentioned last time. You might want to talk about it again.
Merv,
exactly, which is a Persian city. But the center of early early Islam is in that city as well. And it comes out of the monastic traditions of the Church of the East, and various, you know, arguments about what is what, about Jesus and all that sort of thing. So the best way to look at it, you know, we can talk about it some other time, but the best way to look at it is that it's the Church of the East version of Arianism, i.e. questioning the status of God, of Jesus's godhood. And by questioning Jesus' divinity, you come up with all these different things, i.e. Arianism in the West and Islam in the East. But the point is that this widespread faith system is certainly dismantled, but it's dismantled in order that it might be replaced by another version of what has always been there. So we're not looking at the dynamic of conquest. This whole idea of, you know, Arabs bursting out and killing everybody in the millions and all that sort of thing. It's a very difficult thing to, we can talk about this again some other time, but it's a very difficult thing to pinpoint in history and especially in archaeology. So if you're going to talk about, you know, Arabs bursting out and just taking over the world, where's the archaeological evidence for it? You know, it's a very difficult thing to find. And that shouldn't be so given how dynamic it was. So what instead...
How married to written text as well.
I'm sorry?
And how married the generation was to written texts and so forth. And exactly. Traditions, and oral traditions and recounting things of that early generation.
Exactly, yes. So what we're really talking about is simply Christians that just flipped over into this version of the faith. That's what happened.
A lot of that happened too in North Africa as well.
Exactly, yes.
And then perhaps it was a relief in the North African context. Maybe you can apply it to your knowledge of the Far Asian context. In the West, so see if you can respond to the East. In the West, it seems that people were really burned out with, the type of hair splitting and the type of sectarianism. And one of the charms of Islam is its simplicity, doctrinally and so forth. Would you say an attractive point in the farther East? Was there the type of, like you had the Donatists and the Catholics and things in North Africa going back and forth for centuries, really, on top of Arians, on top of other sorts? Was there that sort of wrangling? Do you think the acceptance of Islam there and its simplicity was in reaction to that possible burnout?
That kind of dynamic didn't really exist. That hair splitting did not happen in the East so much as in the West. So that's the first thing. Second thing we have to be aware of, this is just in the East again, we have to be aware of is that when the flipping over into the Islam version of the faith happened, i.e. Islam version of Christianity happened, it happens at a very particular time in history. It happens in the 14th century. It's not a general process, but it's a very concerted political event. And that political event is tied up with the personality of Tamerlane. We mentioned him last time, but we have to always end up with him in the East because he basically destroys the Church of the East in the East. And it's his, it's his life work. He wants to do this. And this is what he sets himself to do, to get rid of the heretics. And just like, think of it as a crusade. And in the East, the crusades are very successful. And the crusader in the East is Tamerlane. And his crusade is to get rid of the heretics that are occupying Christian land for him. and replacing the heresy with the true faith.
We are up on 45 minutes, believe it or not, already. Are there any other photos or topics you would like to cover in this regard?
I think we're done.
Okay. I think our voices are done too, but we did a good go of it, and I think we learned a lot. I certainly did. I can absolutely say that. If anyone would like to contact us, suggest possible show topics, or indeed suggest and then offer yourself as an expert, you're more than welcome to write us at christianhistoryandideas@gmail.com. Also, any, you know, correspondence in general, if you benefited from the show, it's always pleasant to receive such feedback and to keep a type of intellectual community and discourse going behind the scenes there. So you're more than welcome for that. Dr. Das, please tell us something or a few things we might want to keep an eye out for in the postal this happy month of January.
Sure. In the next issue in February, frog in the throat, we're getting a very interesting interview with Austrian philosopher Konrad Liesmann. And he's written a very interesting book called Education as Provocation. It hasn't been translated into English yet, unfortunately. But it's a book that discusses the failure of education system in the West, how we no longer need well-educated people, and yet we think we don't need well-educated people, and yet we do, because without well-educated people, we don't have a world. Also, he looks at this idea of where democracy will end up if we keep doing what we're doing, which is uneducating people, de-skilling people as opposed to skilling them with anything. So education, and then he gets into the dynamic of skill versus education, where people go to universities or colleges because in order to get a better job. And of course, none of that happens. So it's a very interesting interview. And I would encourage people to come by and have a look in February. This is going to be the February issue. That's going to be coming up.
Excellent. Well, the Gmail site and Dr. Das's postal, as well as my announcement, they'll all be in the description here. And that is simply if you are interested in the education world, and in particular the current events in education, I do on my channel a bi-weekly presentation on that very topic. So staying up to date with the field. And if you're interested in Dr. Das's and mine, or our college, or however the grammar works after filming two shows, you'll give us a break. You can go to apocalypsestasisinstitute.wordpress.com and you can find out all about that. So we will sit on our next topic. We will not tell you what our next topic is, but it will be very worthwhile. So Dr. Das, as we leave everyone in great suspense, thank you for your expertise.
Thank you so much, John. It's a pleasure.
And thank you, viewers, and we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.